The time is 12:01. Welcome now to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, the monthly collaborative series between 98.7 WFMT and the Chicago Public Library at the Harold Washington Library Center. Victoria Lautman's guest this month is Richard Russo in an interview recorded last Wednesday at the Harold Washington Library. Graver Capital Management, LLC, proudly presents these broadcasts of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, which is also made possible in part by Seminary Co-op Bookstores, three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. Seminary Co-op Bookstores are widely admired because this consumer-owned bookstore is actually three Chicago bookstores. The flagship store at 5757 South University Avenue is one of the world's best academic bookstores, and it carries about 200,000 titles. Currently, they recommend Uncommon Sense, Economic Insights from Marriage to Terrorism by Gary S. Becker and Richard A. Posner, just released by the University of Chicago Press. 57th Street Books at 1301 East 57th Street is a charming neighborhood bookstore that's featuring Hardball, a V.I. Warshawski novel by Sarah Paretsky, published by Putnam. And the Newberry Library Bookshop at 60 West Walton specializes in cartography, music, history, cards, and gifts. They're recommending Chicago, a biography by Dominic A. Pasiga, beautifully produced by the University of Chicago Press. Enjoy Seminary Co-op Bookstore's 10% member discounts, worldwide shipping, special order services, and author events. Seminary Co-op Bookstores, three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. Phone 800-777-1456 and at semcoop.com.
That is great. Thank you. Why, thank you. Thank you. And welcome. Thank you so much to the inaugural presentation of the sixth season of Writers on the Record. I'm Victoria Lautman, here again at the Harold Washington Library. So happy to be partnering here at this wonderful location with fantastic people, and of course also with 98.7 WFMT Radio. This is our sixth year of our partnership, and it's just going great. Thanks to all of you. I also want to thank now Graver Capital Management, LLC, for underwriting the sixth season of the program, without which I would not be here and you would not be here. Also to Seminary Co-op, one of our fine independent booksellers in Chicago. We need those booksellers. And they schlep the books down here every month, and I'm very grateful to them and to everybody at the library for helping make this happen. You can hear seemingly an endless number of interviews with Writers on the Record going back 6 years at www.victorialautman.com. So if you want to listen to Elizabeth Strout, Augustine Burroughs, Andrea Barrett, Russell Banks, Richard Price, and then soon Richard Russo will be up there in another couple of weeks. We will have some questions after the break, and I hope people will come up and ask some. But now the reason why you're here, let me just say this, that 5 years ago, my guest, Richard Russo, gave the commencement address at Colby College, and his first point to the graduating class was this: be careful not to wake up at age 35 or 40, or in my case, above 50, and discover that you are living the wrong life. Be careful to pay attention to your passions and to follow them. I thought that was an especially interesting thing to read because Russo seems very briefly to have nearly done that himself by studying anthropology at college before eventually turning to creative writing. And if you can just imagine this for a moment, Richard Russo digging up bones somewhere in a pit, looking at early man, instead of concocting such revered novels as Straight Man and Bridge of Sighs and Nobody's Fool, or, of course, his 2002 Pulitzer winner, Empire Falls. But the point Russo made about missing your chance at the right life is also something that seems to plague so many of the characters in his books. And boy, his seventh novel, That Old Cape Magic, is no exception. It is such a pleasure to welcome Richard Russo. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I was fascinated. I know you were only in anthropology for two semesters, but the fact that you were even thinking of being an anthropologist was kind of fascinating to me. Could you just, that was kind of a
bad...
Oh, but
that's only because I didn't know what it was.
You just wanted to be a professor.
Actually, there were two things at work at the time. I had grown up in upstate New York in a small mill town, Gloversville. And my first thought was, or probably it wasn't even my first thought, it was probably my mother's first thought, was that I had to get out of Gloversville. There was a sense in the community that its best days were behind them, which turned out to be prophetically true. So I wanted to go someplace far away. I don't know whether I hadn't heard of California, but Arizona seemed a good distance to go. And they had a good anthropology program, and it was archaeology that I think I had some sort of Indiana Jones notion, probably, although that was before Indy. I had some sort of notion of it as a romantic profession, and so I announced myself there at that first guidance session as an anthropology major, signed up for Introduction to Anthropology, and found out what it was. But I'd also noticed when I was signing up, this was back in the day, when you didn't sign up by a computer, you had to actually stand in an enormous auditorium waiting in lines to sign up for all courses. And I happened to notice that an inordinate number of really pretty girls were standing in the English department line. And so, as I cast about, realizing as I did, you know, it probably took me a couple of months to realize what anthropology was. But once I did, and was casting about for an alternative, that was the first thing that popped into my mind.
Pretty girls, English class, great.
There you go.
Oh, as good a reason as any. Well, you know, the book, That Old Cape Magic, actually, as I understand it, started as a short story, which is interesting in itself, considering you only have one small book of short stories. But is it fair to say that the course of this story and book was changed because of bird poop?
I think so, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I know it sounds stupid, but explain that.
Well, I had.
It's true.
Yeah, yeah. I had a story. I was coming off my previous novel, The Bridge of Sighs, which is a book that took me longer to write than any of my other novels, and also took me to a very deep, dark place. And it hadn't occurred to me in writing that book that if you write a book about despair and you really get to know your characters, it's very hard to write about a man kind of tumbling into a pit of personal despair without some of that rubbing off on you. And I'm not a particularly despairing person. I'm a cautious optimist about most things in life. But following Lucy Lynch in that book put me into a place that was both exhausting and very dark, and I didn't think I had it in me to start another novel right there. I thought that the tank was empty. And so I thought, well, I'll write a short story, and let's make it light. And so I had this character, Jack Griffin, who's the protagonist of this novel, and I thought, well, let's put him on the road. We'll send him to Cape Cod. My wife and I had been to the Cape recently for a wedding. Weddings were in my mind because I had two daughters who were going to be getting married within a calendar year of each other. So I was thinking about weddings, and so I thought, well, just what's going to happen is that this character Jack Griffin will go to the Cape for a wedding, and I thought, what's he doing on the Cape if his wife's not with him for the wedding? I said, well, we'll put the other thing that he's going to do is he's going to scatter his father's ashes. So now we've got a man going to Cape Cod for a wedding. But first, he's going to scatter his father's ashes, which are in an urn in a wheel well in the trunk of his Miata. And then I thought, okay, well, this is becoming clearer to me now. He will drive to the Cape. So this will be the story of kind of a three-hour journey. He'll leave Boston. He'll go to the Cape. He'll look for a place to scatter his father's ashes. And he and his wife have had a tiff. So if he scatters his father's ashes successfully, what does that mean? Well, ironically, it might mean that he doesn't need his wife to do this for this duty. And maybe, since they've had an argument, maybe the argument is even deeper than he thought. And maybe he'll conclude that he doesn't need her at all. That'll be the end of the story. Hmm. Or if he fails to scatter his father's ashes, conversely, that leads to a happier ending, because maybe it means that he really needs his wife, not just for the scattering of the ashes, but indeed for everything, just as presumably he did when they were married. So that's the choice that's presented to the character. I don't know at this point how it's going to resolve itself, but it seems to me that it will be one of those two things. He'll either scatter the ashes or he'll fail to, and his argument with his wife will either be deeper than he thought, revealing more than he thought, or it will amount to nothing at all. But then, as he's just about to get to Provincetown, out the Cape, a surprising thing happens. His mother calls him on his cell phone. Hadn't occurred to me that his mother was still alive until she called, but apparently she was. Apparently she was, because she did. And Griffin pulls over to the side of the road to talk to his mother. They have a very, I won't even describe the conversation that much, but at the end of it, while he's sitting there on the side of the road, the trucks rolling by, he gets crapped on by a seagull. And he does what a man that age in a Miata will do. It's the only thing in his power to do. He blames his mother. Right? She's made a stationary target of him. And this is the result. And when that happened, when the seagull crapped on Griffin and he blamed his mother, I suddenly realized I was writing something more than a short story. It was something. We were dealing now with parents. We were dealing with inheritance, a lot of things. And suddenly, that was probably page 17. And I thought I had maybe three or four more pages at that point to write. And it turned out then it was page 27 and then page 57 and page 77. And then around page 200, I was thinking to myself, well, you know, if I can milk another 50 pages out of this, I can fob this off on an unwitting public as a novel. But then, of course, at page 250, it turned out to be about halfway through, at least in manuscript pages.
So you see, really, the course of this was changed by bird poop. I got
yeah,
that.
Yeah,
you heard
yeah,
it here. Well, the thing about this Jack Griffin, though, and it's great to see how your mind works in this. It mm-hmm. actually, you are a slave to the automatic process in your brain. You didn't even know the guy's mom was alive. The bird was going to poop on him.
Right.
Obviously, a lot of things can happen to affect whatever you started out thinking. But the fact that this character superficially seems so much like you, same age, long marriage. Mm-hmm. He's real cranky, though, when the book opens. He's had a fight with his wife.
Right.
And we see how really the thought process of what is going on in his life and with his marriage and his parents' marriage. All of these things, I think people are going to read as so autobiographical that your wife, Barbara, to whom you've been married for 36 years,
yep.
wanted to come along on the book tour to say, it's not about me, this isn't about us. Nope.
Yeah.
Fiction.
Barbara did. The first month of the book tour, when the book came out in August, Barbara went everywhere with me. At that point, we were just tooling around New England, and we went to the Cape and to Martha's Vineyard, and she did. She wanted to get the story out there. That this was not an autobiographical novel, which it isn't, particularly despite the similarities, as you said. Jack Griffin is also, in his younger days, he was a screenwriter, and as you may know or may not know, I've dabbled in that as well. And I used to be a college professor, and Griffin is now, as the book opens, a college professor. So those are enough similarities to make people wonder about just how close the story is. Close enough to make Janet Maslin wonder in the New York Times if this character, Jack Griffin, who's roughly my age, who's formerly a screenwriter and college professor, if he was having a nervous breakdown, she wondered openly in the New York Times if maybe I was too. So if you had such thoughts, you have some company out there.
Besides Jack Griffin, who is really referred to as Griffin in this story, yeah. I mean, in a way, the people that almost steal the book out from under him, and there's a lot of amazing tangential mm-hmm. characters, his mother and father, one of whom is in the wheel well of the car, the other one ends up in the other wheel well. You'll hear about that. But I would love for you to read the passage that not only illuminates who these just vile but compelling narcissistic freaks are, but how the book actually got its name, that old Cape Magic. So we're going to read from very, very early on in the book.
If I can find the page here, yeah, okay. And, you know, I'll just preface this also by saying that if my mother were alive, and she died a couple of years ago, and that was one of the things too that made me start thinking about inheritance. You know, the way in which after our parents die, my father had been dead for close to two decades. But I hate to break this to those of you who hasn't dawned on yet, but when they die, they don't go away. You know, the voices remain. But if my mother were here, she would also have wanted to come on this book tour to tell all of you that she is not Jack Griffin's mother in this book, and on her behalf, she's not here to speak for herself anymore. But my mother, neither of my parents were academics, but let me introduce you to a couple of them. Zipping along Route 6, Griffin realized he was humming That Old Black Magic, the song his parents had sung ironically. Both university English professors, that was how they did most things, ironically. Every time they crossed the Sagamore, substituting the word cape for black. When he was growing up, they would spend part of every summer on the Cape. He could always tell what kind of year it had been, money-wise, by where and when they stayed. One particular prosperous year, they had rented a small house in Chatham for the month of August. Another year is when faculty salaries were frozen. All they could afford was a week in sandwich in June. His parents had been less wed to each other than to a shared sense of grievance over having been exiled 11 months of every year to the Midwest, a phrase that they didn't say so much as spit. They had good academic careers, though perhaps not the stellar ones that might have been predicted given their Ivy League pedigree. Both had grown up in the Rust Belt of Western New York State, his mother in suburban Rochester, his father in Buffalo, the children of lower middle-class white-collar parents. At Cornell, where they had both gone on scholarship, they had met not only each other, but also the kinds of friends who invited them home for holidays in Wellesley and Westchester, and for summer vacations in the Hamptons and on the Cape. They told their parents that they could earn more money there, which was true. But in fact, they would have done anything to avoid returning to their parents' depressing upstate homes. At Yale, where they did their graduate work, they came to believe that they were destined for research positions at one of the other Ivies, at least until the market for academics headed south, and they had to take what they could get, the pickings even slimmer for a couple. And that turned out to be a huge state university in Indiana. Betrayed. That was how they felt. Why go to Cornell, to Yale, if Indiana was your reward? But they had little choice but to hunker down and make the best of their wretched timing, so they dove into teaching and research and committee work, hoping to bolster their vitae so that when the academic winds changed, they'd be ready. They feared the Princeton and Dartmouth ships had probably sailed for good. But that still left the Swarthmores and Vassars of the world as a safe, if not terribly exciting, haven. This much, at least, was surely their due. And before going up for promotion and tenure, or promotion and tether in their parlance, in the Midwest, they each had opportunities, his mother at Amherst, his father at Bowdoin, but never together. And so they stayed put in their jobs and their marriage, each terrified, Griffin now suspected, that the other, unshackled, would succeed and escape to the kind of academic post and endowed chair that would complete the misery of the one left behind. To make their unhappy circumstances more tolerable, they had affairs and pretended to be deeply wounded when these came to light. Griffin's father had been a genuine serial adulterer, whereas his mother simply refused to lag behind in this or anything else.
Richard Russo, reading from reading from his seventh novel, That Old Cape Magic. And they're just such despicable but funny snobs, these two. And there's a great story within a story in this book, which becomes actually a short story that Griffin is writing. The Summer of the... What is your name? The Summer of the...
Oh, and I've lost it as well. Summer of the...
Thank
Brownings.
You.
Thank you.
Thank
very
you. The
much.
Summer
Thank
of the Brownings. Okay.
Summer of the Brownings.
Yes, here
yes,
we go.
Yes.
That I think so perfectly explains how awful this kid's childhood was, with this pair of narcissists who could easily remember their newspaper in the morning but could never remember to get his cereal, and
right.
self-professed child haters. And the idea that this kid goes away for 2 weeks with his parents, that's all they want to do is drink gin on the beach and get rid of him. And he falls in love with another family.
Yeah.
It's just, it's so pathetic and so sweet. And I have to think that you needed to create these terrible parents in order to create a character like Griffin to explain why he is the way he is, although he marries a woman who's one of five kids and mm-hmm. four kids. They all love each other. And so in constructing those parents, were you being led by Griffin, or was Griffin being led by them?
I think probably some of both. Griffin's parents the first thing to say is I've also known a lot of academics like this. One of the things that happens in universities is that there are, of course, economic downturns in universities, just like everywhere else. And what happens people who get their degrees from places like Harvard and Yale end up in state universities is that they're just disgruntled. They're bitter. I've known a lot of them because I had a great case of the academic runs there for a while. I went and taught in a lot of different places.
Well, this book has got a lot of
yep.
in common with Straight Man, which
yes,
is your
yes,
book about
yeah,
that very
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, yeah. And they always reminded me of Scuffy the Tugboat, you know, that child's story, Scuffy who's unhappy in the bathtub, you know, and he believes that he was made for bigger things. And of course the little boy takes him out and puts him in the stream, and he sails off, and then only begins to discover how frightened he is when he gets close to the ocean. But academics, like Griffin's parents in this book, they have the what I think of as the Scuffy the Tugboat mentality. They were made, if you believe that you were made for better things, then you're just not going to be happy where you are. And when they go to the Cape, when they go to Cape Cod, hoping one day to buy a house there, they quickly divide all of the real estate listings in one of two categories, which are: can't afford it, and wouldn't have it as a gift. If those are your categories in life, you're not going to raise a healthy child. that much seemed clear. And parents like that were necessary for Griffin to make what I think was... I think Griffin is a really smart guy. Probably not quite as smart as his wife, but I think he's a smart guy. But like a lot of smart people, he has a kind of blind spot. There are certain ways in which people can be enormously intelligent, and yet there's a certain area in their life where they've attached to a belief that they cannot surrender, no matter how obviously wrong it is. And I think what Griffin has, the belief that he has attached himself to, is that we can somehow keep our parents out of our lives, that we can deny our inheritance. This is the story of a man who really over 30 or 35 years of his marriage, even as he has watched his father's nose take over the center of his own face, even as he has heard his mother's words come out of his mouth again and again, he has clung to this belief that by a sheer force of will, we can deny them. We cannot let them into our lives. We cannot let them influence our marriage. We can keep them away from our children. We can do all sorts of things. And I think, but you have to create parents, first of all, that a man would want to do that for. And so those two academics were born.
So many of the reviews of this book have talked about it being so different, like a real departure from all your earlier books. There is no, like, the bar to Main Street thing, yeah, of yours. And yet the fact that you created the, I mean, these have got to be two of the most loathsome characters you devised, although the lady in Empire Falls was close, but not as funny.
Yeah.
I mean, do you see it as that much of a departure? Really, just it's more internal. It's not taking place in a small town. But have you found this to be that big of a departure in terms of how you wrote it and the kinds of characters you populated it with?
I think it's different. I think the critics are right to a certain extent. I think that they are they're right in that obviously this is not a blue collar milieu, and the issues of class that have been front and center in my novels a lot, and really came to full expression in Bridge of Sighs, are not here. These people, Jack and Joy, are well educated. They don't have a lot of money problems. They're not wealthy, but they don't have a lot of money problems. So I think that people, after reading Empire Falls and Bridge of Sighs, would look at the size of this book, and they would look at the absence of a mill town replaced by Cape Cod of all things, and they would say, "This is a departure." I think it's less of a departure for anybody who's read Straight Man, which is another novel about a middle-aged guy and who's kind of circling the drain. So I don't think it would be that much of a departure for them. The interest in family certainly has been there in all of my novels. The other different thing, of course, in this is that where all of my other novels were set in real places, they were fictional, but they were these gritty mill towns in upstate New York and then later one in Maine. The world of that old Cape Magic takes place in really an almost mythical landscape. And one of the, I just got back from Cape Cod in August, and I toured with this novel there, and it was wonderful to tour with a novel set with Cape Cod in the title, and then to tour on Cape Cod with this book.
Yeah, we get the They got the better part of that deal.
But interestingly enough, one of the things that I was a little bit worried about was that people would realize that when people who lived on the Cape and read it and hoped to find their Cape were going to be disappointed, because of course, this is not about Cape Cod by any stretch. This is, and this I hadn't done before, except tangentially in Empire Falls. This is about a particular American mindset that we've always had, but it has really come to the fore right now, within the last probably 20 years or so. That notion of a finer place, that a place exists where we will be happier, a place that is in finer in all the kind of ways that we can imagine for a place to be finer. And yet somehow one of the things that we haven't factored into the finer place is ourselves. right? When we will be there, if we chase the shimmer along and shimmer this kind of oasis, if we ever capture it, then we'll be there, which already makes it less interesting, right? By virtue of the fact that we have arrived there, but I mean, I think of it as what happens in the morning. You know, you wake up, you log onto your computer, and there's that little thing in the whatever your web page is that comes up, and it says 10 best places in the world to live. Show of hands, who doesn't click on that? Yeah, thank you, sir. but most of us do, and the world, I think America has changed, and our lives in America have changed. My mother grew up, or my mother spent most of her working in life in General Electric in Schenectady, and she was a career GE person, and she believed, as people did who worked for Ford and GM and all of those big companies, that you would take care of the company and the company would take care of you, and it was kind of a lifelong relationship. And very often jobs for people in companies like General Electric and Ford got passed down from father to son, mother to daughter. And there was a sense that where you grew up was a good place to be, and there was a sense that, you know, you had family kind of down the block, and the place that you were was a pretty good place. And I don't think that that's true in America anymore. We know it's true that there's almost nobody anymore that believes that a company is going to take care of you. And people change jobs all the time now, always looking for a better job, looking for a better place. It's kind of a fool's errand, I think, but it's one, there are a lot of fools, and I count myself among those.
That sounds like a good place to stop for right now. Richard Russo counting himself among the fools. I like that quote. We're going to take a really short break. Don't go away. We're listening to Richard Russo talk about his seventh novel, That Old Cape Magic, here on Writers on the Record with Victoria Laub, and thank you.
You're tuned to 98.7 WFMT Chicago and our monthly broadcast of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lockman. Graver Capital Management LLC proudly presents these broadcasts of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lockman, which is also made possible in part by Seminary Co-op Bookstores. Seminary Co-op Bookstores are widely admired because this consumer-owned bookstore is actually three Chicago bookstores. The flagship store at 5757 South University Avenue is one of the world's best academic bookstores, and it carries about 200,000 titles. Currently, they recommend Uncommon Sense, Economic Insights from Marriage to Terrorism by Gary S. Becker and Richard A. Posner, just released by the University of Chicago Press. 57th Street Books at 1301 East 57th Street is a charming neighborhood bookstore that's featuring Hardball, a V.I. Warshawski novel by Sarah Paretsky, published by Putnam. And the Newberry Library Bookshop at 60 West Walton specializes in cartography, music, history, cards, and gifts. They're recommending Chicago, a biography by Dominic A. Pasiga, a beautifully produced book by the University of Chicago Press. Enjoy Seminary Co-op Bookstores 10% member discounts, worldwide shipping, special order services, and author events. Seminary Co-op Bookstores, three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. Phone 800-777-1456 and at semcoop.com.
Welcome back to Writers on the Record. I want to just give you a couple dates coming up while I can before we get back to Richard Russo here. October 22nd, next month, it's going to be Sherman Alexie. November 19th, Audrey Niffenegger talking about her new book. The season continues with Hodgin, Peter Carey, Lionel Shriver. Also, just another plug here, too, for the Humanities Festival. If you're fans of Laurie Moore or Jonathan Latham, I'll be interviewing each of them the first weekend in November. But now back to Richard Russo, who is, of course, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Empire Falls and The Risk Pool and Bridge of Sighs. And if you've never read his short stories and The Horse Child, fantastic book. And, yes, he's written a lot of screenplays, including the one for his own HBO version of Empire Falls and then The Ice Harvest. So he's done a lot of different things. And he just revealed to me that his little zip drive in his pocket has several screenplays on it. So if you jump him after this today, you're going to ruin his career. He's probably still paying for those marriages, you know, for his daughters. And actually, that was something I was curious about, because I know really in the course of writing this book, you lost your mother. I mean, mm-hmm. your father died years ago, mm-hmm. two daughters, often getting married, and you had this idea for Griffin and these characters before, but since your process seems to be like automatic writing, you're just allowing things to come into your work, how did those end up shaping the future of that old Kate Magic?
Yeah, and the funny part of it is, I don't know if a writer has told you this before, but quizzing a writer about how this happened after the fact, you could put me under, you know, under a headlamp with a couple of tough cops and slap me silly, and there's certain things that I can't remember, a lot of things that I can't remember. Once the process begins to work, you kind of forget the steps along the way. And whenever anybody's asked me what the process is about a particular book, even if I've just finished it, very often I have forgotten how I was led from one thing to another. I can tell you, how could I deny the fact that here is a book about inheritance, my own mother's passing, the fact that my daughters, both of my daughters, were getting married. So I was thinking, clearly I must have been thinking about what I had inherited from my parents, the kinds of things that you know, we're all haunted, as I said earlier, we're all kind of haunted in that way. When our parents are gone, we continue to have the discussions with them that we had when they were alive. That never goes away. But then also when your kids start getting married and you start thinking, well, if that's true for me and my parents, yeah, you're following me, aren't you? Then what exactly, because my parents didn't know what they were giving me, you know, the things that have haunted me would not have been the things that they have predicted, which kind of means that what my wife and I are passing along to our daughters, what they're remembering and the, you know, the phrases that are going to come out of their mouths that are traceable back to Barbara and to me are probably not what we would guess. So what have we inherited, and what have we given to our children? What have they inherited from us? Will it be good stuff? Will it be bad stuff? What will be the mixture? And so all of those, I was thinking about all of those things, but if you were to ask me specifically, when did Laura, for instance, my character who's Griffin's daughter, when did I decide that, all right, we'll go to a wedding, I can't remember exactly when things happened. But.
No, I was just more curious about how those big general things affect the book.
Yeah.
And you,
yeah.
That's
yeah.
good.
Yeah.
But I want to actually move into another topic here, and that is back to some of the ancillary characters, because mm-hmm. really, you know, you'll mention somebody in passing and then involve us in a 10-page story about that person.
Yeah.
There's a number of them, and they're fantastic. Each one of these characters could be a wonderful short story in themselves. The one that I found most captivating, and I think you probably did too, is Sonny Kim, who you're going to read a little passage about, going back to when he was a much younger boy, 13. And this is a kid who was the most uncomfortable, you know, son of Korean immigrants. And, you know, he wasn't exactly brutalized or bullied, mm-hmm. but almost. And I realized that you really have a soft spot for these tortured teenagers, mainly boys, in your books. I thought of every single book you've written. There's always somebody in one of them, whether or Sister Ursula in The Story of the Horse Child.
I
mean,
yeah.
Or Voss. Or I mean, you obviously have a great deal of empathy. And there was one reference you made somewhere to kind of having an idea of what that was like. And I know that your parents were separated when you were young. Mm-hmm. You did live through a lot of the kinds of situations that come up in your books over and over again. Divorced.
Sure.
you know, family, your rogue father, hardworking mom, mm-hmm. and these boys who seem to have been somehow bullied as kids. And is that you?
I have great sympathy for outsiders and for kids who have endured this. I was actually quite fortunate. My parents did separate when I was young, and I did go through as a kid the thing that always happens, I think, to kids when their parents separate and one of them goes away, which is to say, to internalize it and say, all right, what did I do? Is this my fault? And I remember, too, that I used to think with longing about my father who was absent and wondering why he would have left. You know, not only did I do something wrong, but just why is he gone? And then he would be gone just long enough that I would just about forget about him, and then he'd be there again. So I was constantly watching for him. But what saved me from an awful lot of what a lot of my characters go through is that we lived upstairs from my grandparents. I had wonderful, wonderful grandparents. I spent as much time with them as I did with my own parents. And down the street, I had a bunch of cousins. So I became part of a very large family that I was included in. So I never felt unloved. There were mysteries in the back of my mind that I was always trying to solve. Why did this happen? Did it have something to do with me? But I didn't suffer away a lot of the kids certainly nothing like John Voss, and certainly nothing like Sister Ursula, that poor woman from The Horse Child. Why do I empathize with people like that? That's a tougher one. That goes into an even deeper place than I probably have access to. But I do sympathize with people who find themselves. Especially young, because it hurts the young so much more, who find themselves in deeply humiliating situations.
Well, you have a great description of one. and Sonny Kim is just, a wonderful character that I don't know what you were channeling at that point, if you were planning to have
nor
guy
do
in
I.
there. But
yeah. Yeah, Sonny has been invited to Jack Griffin's daughter's, I think it's 12th birthday party here. So, Sonny is the outsider. He's also the smartest kid in the class. The last time Griffin had seen Sonny was at Laura's 13th birthday party. Joy had to banish him from the kitchen, where he wanted to be put to work. "You're a guest," she told him. "Join the others and have fun." The one thing the poor kid had no idea how to do. "I wish it would get dark," Griffin remembered telling his wife. "I can't bear to watch this." As instructed, Sonny had joined the others on the patio, but seemed to have little in common with the other boys who had congregated, as boys will, near the food, strutting and joking and pushing and checking out the giggling girls who had cleverly staked out the punch bowl. Sonny had positioned himself in the middle, as if he represented a third gender, smiling broadly at nothing in particular, his head bobbing arrhythmically to the horrible boy band music, pretending, Griffin was sure, to enjoy himself. In fact, watching the kid reminded Griffin of his first boy-girl party at a similar age. He should have known how to behave since his parents were forever throwing parties back then. But of course, those were for adults only. He, Griffin, was expected to make a brief appearance after the guests started arriving and then to disappear, which was why, he supposed, he never learned the requisite skills. His first junior high party had been a nightmare. Not only did all the other kids seem to know one another, it also seemed like they'd been going to parties like this for years. Griffin remembered positioning himself where he could see the clock and will it to move. At one point, after he and the others had filled their paper plates with food and food at the buffet table and eaten standing up, a few of the parents hovering around, everyone, it seemed, began trooping downstairs into the rec room, where music was playing on a portable record player. Griffin was still on the stairs when the lights went out. It had taken his eyes a minute or two to adjust, and when they finally did, he discovered, to his mortification, that all the other kids were couples, necking in the dark. One boy he knew had his hand up a girl's shirt. "What are you doing down here?" came a voice in the dark, and he'd known with a terrible certainty that he was the one being addressed. I didn't know, he stammered. "Yeah, well, now you do." There had been snickers, lots of them, to help propel him back up the stairs. Poor kid, Griffin remembered thinking as he regarded Sonny outside. He must be suffering just like that.
You know, that's not one of the hilarious passages. It's one of the more poignant ones, although there are so many parts of this book that are hilarious. You walk that line always in your novels. And it builds to an almost crescendo around one of the weddings and the prenup. Just, it's almost like a slapstick cinematic moment. I can see it on the screen. I hope you're writing a screenplay for it. And I know that you've said that you were writing like the worst things you could imagine that could happen at a wedding because your daughter's about to get married and this is a talisman. But what I found even more stunning was a story about your own nuptial night. Your own wedding night.
Oh, God, really, we're going there.
It sounds like one of the worst things ever. The fact that you continued to be married to Barbara for 36 years after. I mean, once
or that she continued to be married to me. Yeah.
So you can mine a fair amount of things from your life, whether it's your rogue father, your hardworking mother, your hideous wedding night. Try to get it out of your system.
They want to know this story. You know they do.
And you're going to get to hear it now. And then we're going to take some questions.
Yeah, okay.
Will you tell us?
My wife and I were married in Tucson, Arizona, where her family is from. We were both at the University of Arizona. I was a graduate student at the time. Barbara was finishing up her senior year. And we had no money. We had pooled enough resources to get the train from Tucson down to Mazatlan, Mexico. And I believe the extent of our stay was 3 days. And we had reserved what was called on this Mexican train an alcoba, a sleeping car. But I had cleverly taken a wrong turn, thought I knew the way down to Nogales. I'd been down there before, but I had cleverly taken a wrong turn, and we had lost, it had taken us about 20 minutes to figure that out, and so we had lost 40 minutes, and we had left late anyway, left from the reception late. And so we sped down to Nogales. We got through the border, we checked, and the train was moving. And it was one of those cinematic things. And the guy who normally stamps visas was there. And he just said, "Go, go, 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 go." And so we ran. We had our bags. We caught, in great cinematic fashion, the train, only to discover walking down the aisle is, of course, crowded with people and chickens. And it's a Mexican train. And we got to the sleeping car, and of course they had given away our sleeping car. There are no longer any seats on the train, so nothing for us to do but, you know, hang out with the chickens in the center aisle. And we thought, God, it can't get any worse than this. And you should never think that, by the way, in any situation, because it did. And the guy came through checking visas, and of course neither of our visas are stamped. And so we are hauled off down to, but it was wonderful. It was an air-conditioned car where there was a man with a stamp. And boy, did he read us the riot act! And he kept telling us that he was going to put us off the train and everything. But then we mentioned the magic word that we were on our honeymoon. Honeymoon. Which meant that we could give him $20 and he would stamp our, he was a romantic. For $20, he stamped our visas and he sent us back to the chickens, for which I guess we counted ourselves grateful. But anyway, we were up all night. We finally got seats around, with the train left around 5 in the afternoon. We finally got seats around 1 in the morning as people got off the train and then the air conditioning kicked in, and along about 3 o'clock in the morning, it was freezing. We never slept a wink. on our night, on our honeymoon night. We sat up in a Mexican train with the chickens. And of course, then the next day, we arrived early in the morning. Of course, our hotel is not ready, right? They said, there's a changing room, go to the beach, come back at 3 o'clock, your room will be ready. We went to the beach, we put down our blankets and fell blissfully asleep for about 5 hours under the hot Mexican sun. And by the time we woke up, we were so cooked that we could not touch each other for the remainder of our honeymoon.
Thank you. I'm so glad you told that.
And she's still with me 37 years later.
If somebody has questions, it's a good time to, we probably won't get to that many of them, but so make your way up to one of the microphones. We've just got 10 minutes left or so, but while people are doing that, you know, here's a really mean-spirited comment for me, and that is that just a little while after the book came out, somebody, woman, had the nerve in Newsweek on their blog to write an article saying, is Richard Russo a misogynist?
And we know that there's only one possible answer when you phrase it that way. Yeah.
Well, it actually caused, I mean, it was picked up by a lot of other sort of literary blogs, and a lot of people wrote in your defense. And,
yeah.
But how did you, I mean, that is just like an incredible thing to see written about yourself, whether you think, obviously you don't think it's true, but how do you feel really powerless in a situation like that? Do you care? Does it matter?
Well, of course it matters, and I remember too that my first, having been raised Catholic, my first instinct was that it must be true. When anybody, so it took me when I heard about it, and I had just started on tour, so I knew I was going to be having to address the question throughout much of my tour, but so it took me a while to go back through my fiction and convince myself that it wasn't true. And a number of people did come to my defense. What I felt worst about was my daughters, because I actually heard about it through my daughter, Emily, who had seen it. And both of my daughters had exactly the same reaction, which I think you'll find is curious, because they ran the photo that they ran next to that headline, is Richard Russo a misogynist, and then an article the woman from this, Jack's mother from this novel, and several other of my female characters, concluding that I was in fact a misogynist. But there was an accompanying photo taken of me on the front porch of my house, and both of my daughters saw that, and they concluded, they both of them wrote to me immediately and said, that woman was in our house. For them, it was like a home invasion. They didn't welcome the article or anything like that. But what amazed them, and of course, it was just an old AP file. They had just gone back and gotten something else. But for them, it was very, very personal, and they took it much harder than I did. Yeah.
Thank you for addressing that. We do have some questions. Why don't you come a little closer to the microphone? Thanks.
Hi, my name is Jack.
Hi, Jack.
Hi, Richard. Over the summer, I read Straight Man, and I really liked it. And one of the things I liked best about it was how tight the writing was. So I was wondering if you could say a few words about the role revision and editing plays in your writing.
Yeah, great question. Thank you. Well, I'll pass that on to my editor. another precinct heard from and appreciated. I have a wonderful editor. I've had two great editors, actually. I do spend, even before it goes to anybody like that, I spend an enormous amount of time revising. Especially the early parts. The early parts of books require more revision than the end. But I spend far more time revising books than I do writing them. It's hard to separate because as you revise, you get a new idea and a new scene will come up. So in the revision process, a new scene will sometimes emerge. It's a truism that most writers tell writing students that writing is revision. And if you don't want to spend time, really on the detail, word to word, comma to comma stuff, you're probably not going to get very good, because ultimately you do have to do that. And so I do that, and then I turn it over to, I've had only two editors during my career. My editor now, Gary Fiskejohn, is a master with a green pencil. And after everything that I think I've done, I have this dream where one day I'm going to deliver a book to Gary and he's going to give me back one page that doesn't have a mark on it. It hasn't happened yet, or even close. But he's a meticulous editor, and he will find things that after I've been staring at them for 4 or 5 years, I can't see anymore. But he's just I will pass along your kind words to him, because a lot of the tightness, and you want the prose to be just as tight as you can possibly make it, and a lot of that comes from the writer's own devotion to accomplishing that. But then at a certain point, we all become blind, and we need not only an editor, but a copy editor. And even after all those people have been through it, you still find mistakes. Thank you.
Hi. My question also refers to the process. How can you turn it off? Like, when you're done for the day, can you just shut down the word processor and go about your day? Or are you constantly making notes for revision? And if so, how does that affect everyone around you?
Good question. Yeah. My wife has come to realize that she sees a certain look in my eye, and she knows that she might as well stop talking to me. I mean, she can continue if she wants to, but she realizes that there's nobody there. And there are times, and I minimize these as much as possible. And I've actually worried about it with regard to my daughters too, because I do know that I spend a certain amount of time when I'm not writing, nevertheless, trying to solve certain problems in the story, certain little intricacies that I've not quite figured out yet. What's the best way to release this information? Is this sentence working? Or whatever. So I spend a certain amount of time working on that, and I wonder if I've asked my daughters recently, did I seem aloof to you? You know, as a father, could you come to me and was I there when you did? And they've mostly reassured me, but I do know that there are times when a writer writes when he's not writing, and if you're related to a writer, you probably have figured that out. But the other thing that you can do, which is enormously helpful for a writer, is that I've learned when I'm writing on any given day, I've learned to stop when I'm going really good. If you know exactly what the next sentence is going to be, if you know exactly the next thing that's going to happen in the story, don't write it. That allows you to get some time away from it instead of torturing yourself with the fact that you don't know the next thing that's going to happen.
I think we have time for one more, but it has to be kind of short.
Well, the answer has to be short.
Yes. Yeah. In other words, you.
Well, I just want to say there were a couple of your characters that will always make me laugh, even just from thinking about them years after reading the book, like Rub Squeers and Max Roby.
Yeah.
And I was wondering that when you write those characters, do you set out to write someone that's going to be sort of comic relief, or is it just a character that you create that more is making you laugh as they're coming alive?
I learned, I think, in writing Mohawk that I am a writer who has a kind of comic vision of the world. And so I don't, which is not to say that I don't find the world at times an absolutely heartbreaking place, but almost always, even the heartbreak comes out in the context of humor. I'm not surprised when people do funny things. And back when I was teaching, I used to alert students that I thought might have that comic sensibility to the fact, because very often in graduate school, writing programs are skewed in exactly the opposite direction. What gets taught is the most serious stuff. And because comedy is hard to teach, maybe impossible to teach, it's often ignored, and so writers sometimes spend an enormous amount of time figuring out such a basic fact as whether or not they are comic writers, because there's nobody there to tell them.
Now you've left a very difficult interlude of probably, 40 seconds? 1 minute? You could.
But with characters like Rob.
No, stop. Yeah.
Characters like Rub, and I'm so glad you mentioned him, because, you know, his
cut it
out. I wished I had a big old cheeseburger. Yeah, I just let them go.
I wish we had another hour. Yeah. I had like 14 more questions I couldn't even get to, but you, because you answered in such perfect depth on all of them. We didn't get to talk about you're maybe going to go back
you're
and
very
talk to
patient.
Sully. Well, this was fantastic, but you, I hope we see you here again in the Midwest so that we can talk about why.
You've only to ask.
Yeah, okay. In the meanwhile, thank you very much, Richard Russo. Thank you to all of you for coming to Writers on the Record. You can listen to this again endlessly, but it will be broadcast this coming Sunday on WFMT at noon. It will be on the website, and I hope I see you all here next month for Sherman Alexie. In the meanwhile, thank you. Thank you, Richard Russo.
Thank you.
The people at Graver Capital Management, LLC, and at Seminary Co-op Bookstores hope you've enjoyed today's broadcast of Writers on the Record with Victoria Laufman. Our special thanks to everyone associated with the series at the Chicago Public Library at the Harold Washington Library Center, including Commissioner Mary Dempsey. Engineers are Eric Arunas and Leland Mosley. Steve Robinson is the executive producer. The host and producer is Victoria Laufman. Graver Capital Management, LLC, proudly presents these broadcasts of Writers on the Record with Victoria Laufman, which is also made possible in part by Seminary Co-op Bookstores, 3 Chicago bookstores with 1 world-class reputation. At 98.7 FM, you're tuned to WFMT Chicago.